our third and fourth dimension of the dialogue of salvation, as Pope Paul calls it, I thought we might add a few words on the practical implementation of our ecumenical work with those who are not Catholics, but Christians. It might be well to remind ourselves that canon law legislates for bishops in a diocese and for priests in a parish, and we, of course, are part of that hierarchical structure. I quote, "Non-Catholics within the diocese and or parish are to be regarded as committed to them by the Lord." In other words, the ecumenical movement, as far as the Church is concerned, goes back already to canon laws recognizing that our responsibilities are not only to the Catholics in our parochial or diocesan confines, but also those who are not Catholic, mainly Protestant. Among the numerous adjustments that hopefully will be made, in fact, will have to be made because the Church is deeply concerned, is in the matter of training of our young people. We are doing something in the seminary where I teach in the Jesuit Theologate. Every Wednesday, for example, we are giving the men the opportunity from early morning after their Mass and meditation until the evening, late in the evening, to work in various ways, particularly in various kinds of social apostolate. We are within 30 miles of Chicago and endless amount of work, both in some of the poorer sections, among the colored, cooperating in ways that I understand some of your sisters have been working in the Cleveland Diocese. Grave needs, which it is high, very high time that sisters became deeply and officially involved. Also, our young people are cooperating with the CCD program, which, again, your sisters have been working on, but also in working with people in public schools. We mentioned something about shared time, also release time. But frankly, for us in education, I think the easiest and most obvious way in which we can implement, we personally, that is, this apostolate of communication is in the field of teaching, the field of education, mainly with those who are not Catholic, mostly teaching in public schools. I couldn't begin to describe how much good we can do if we cooperate with them in various projects, not merely visit them in a kind of tete-a-tete, but anticipating what needs we have. Take a simple thing like our tendency in Catholic schools, I think it's true of most dioceses, of sloughing off our undesirables on the public school system. None of you knows, unless you are involved, what a bad name we have for that reason, sisters, that we have them wash our dirty linen. Catholics, often the product of either broken homes or difficult family adjustments, youngsters whom we cannot tolerate, we cannot handle, or think we cannot, so we slough them off. I'm not that familiar with Cleveland, having been away for some time, just how much Catholic schools are doing, say, for the mentally retarded, for those who are somehow emotionally unbalanced. Much work being done along that line, sisters? Whatever it is, first of all, there's much more than we, I'm confident, are presently coping with. And in so many of these things, it is impossible for us, if there are no other reason than for financial reasons, to handle this privately. Take, for example, the psychiatric help, which many children need. This cries to heaven for some kind of solution. And once more, the financial straits under which most of our schools labor, of course, partly the result of our own dedication to a system of education built, as we believe, in promoting those values which can only be taught, at least best taught, in a church-affiliated school system. On the other hand, there are many specialized services, either for the specially talented, whom we should particularly take care of, or for those who come from difficult backgrounds, and with emphasis, and I come back to that, to our Negroes. I am told, you can correct me on this, you may know figures better than I, upwards of 30% of the population of Cleveland is colored. Something upwards of 1 million Negroes in Chicago. It means that we've got to simply take in and realizing these are souls redeemed by Christ, and that we have not been doing what we should, mark my words, if we ever think that this reformation of morals about which the popes are talking, or for which the council has been convoked, is make-believe, we're deceiving ourselves. I hope it was in this community that I mentioned, it may have been in Chardon. Religious communities, I'm not just speaking of yours or mine, religious communities are in grave need of reformation in living up to, especially by the sins of omission, sisters. I know whereof I speak, and your superiors have given me the freedom of expressing myself. It means that we ourselves, through our teaching, should begin to seriously undertake ways of teaching about other religious traditions, about the kind of people with whom our youngsters, already now, and later on, as men and women, will be living. We won't. There are very few Lutherans or Baptists in your community. I'm being facetious. We were all Catholics. We don't feel the pressure and the challenge of a pluralistic society. And if the nation is going to achieve what God wants it to with the natural resources at its disposal, it will mean because we, as Americans, cooperate with others who have been brought together by God in this nation in this time and work for the upbuilding of society. Consequently, I have recommended before, and I wish to repeat and insist, our schools already from grammar school, certainly in high school, and emphatically in college. This is not a luxury. This is an absolute necessity. We must inform first ourselves, then the children we teach, about the religious values, principles, practices, and ideals of those who are Christians as we are, but are not Catholic. Is it any wonder the latest figure I've seen, 40% of Catholic marriages in which a Catholic is involved are mixed. Did you know that, sisters? Some dioceses over 80%. Now, some mixed marriages, of which no doubt many of us are products, turn out beautifully, at least we feel in our case. But most of them are liabilities to the marrying parties and certainly to the children. For all of these reasons, knowledge, foreknowledge, coming from teaching. Now, to talk in this vein and to make these suggestions and then to ask yourself, well, what will be done? Obviously, all I can do is first to say it and then to pray. It is for you both to pray, and with God's grace, now I beg in His name to do something. In working with others, the Vatican Council, this I'm speaking now still on that type of ecumenical work which is with the Protestants. The Council uses two expressions that I wish to pass on to you. It says that in learning about the religious system of other peoples, first of all, it says, we must get to know the outlook of our separated brethren. Sisters, forget everything else I've said in 2 weeks. Don't forget that. We must get to know the outlook of our separated brethren. That is the mystical body speaking to us through its highest authority, telling us where I know that most sisters will not do it. We must get, the Council wants us to. To achieve this purpose, the Council says, study is of necessity required. We've got to learn about this. Not just reading Grand Maison, or Runner, or Tanqueray. It's also reading about people who don't have our faith. Because it's this society in which the people we're teaching are living. They're not living in the society of Runner and Tanqueray. We are. They are not. To achieve this purpose, study is of necessity required, and this must be pursued with a sense of realism and goodwill. Note those words. Catholics who already have a proper grounding, and sisters, if you don't, who on earth has? If you cannot be trusted with learning something about other religious systems, whom can we trust? This is the green wood, sisters. This is not the dry. Such Catholics need, notice, mandate, to acquire a more adequate understanding, assuming that it is now inadequate, understanding of the respective doctrines of our separated brethren, their history, their spiritual and liturgical life, their religious psychology and general background. And if you think this is exotic, a kind of a salad to the spiritual life, you are wrong. Because for lack of such knowledge, the multi-thousands that finish our schools are unequipped to meet the challenges of this pluralism. And all the meditations and contemplations of a lifetime will not erase this omission. This I did not say this morning. This sense of realism and goodwill, which the Council talks about, is clearly the balance we're supposed to have in dealing with this. In other words, how to study these other religions. Please don't think this is exotic. I didn't create this. The Church of God. First, realism. It means that I do not ignore or underestimate the differences that separate Catholicism from other Christian religious systems. They just think differently, that's all. Such realism will protect us from falling prey to that naive Irenicism that Pope Paul has several times castigated. Notably, some priests and theologians who criticize the Church for being of a ghetto mentality, as though, in other words, the unity we have is somehow superimposed on us, instead of what it is, a gift of the divine spirit from within. So we're not closing our eyes to the vast differences, realism. At the same time, goodwill preserves me from looking for defects in those who are not Catholic. They have them, so do we. Instead of finding what we have in common and on which they and we can build the edifice of spirituality. In closing this section, just a word about the ways in which, in working out the social apostolate of the Church, the opportunities lie all around us. If we personally, as far as we can, and if permission needs to be got, let it be gotten. If superiors hesitate, let them ask further superiors. And if they doubt, let them contact the bishop. And what I mentioned before, let me repeat. Bishops feel that religious women are not as cooperating with the hierarchy as they should. We are not living a provincial life separate from the hierarchy, from the mystical body, which for us is governed by the successors of the apostles. We are exempt, indeed, sisters. We are not exempt from cooperating with those whom Christ has put to lead us. Social apostolate of every kind, we cannot, obviously undercut, nor should we, the established school systems that we have. But I am thinking of weaving in, permeating, thinking through the apostolic dimension from childhood on through our children. It means, of course, there'd be times we will have to step outside of a Catholic classroom and maybe lift our skirts as we walk through the mud of the slums. Maybe. God is going to protect us, certainly speaking to the church. He wants us to keep and to develop what we have, but in His name, to work with others, millions who might come to know, respect, and love, who are Christians. First time that I had dinner with an Episcopal minister whom I'd come to know very well, I was embarrassed. Married man indeed, has a child. The man was living poverty that I have seldom seen inside of a monastery or religious community. There wasn't a square foot of rug in that room. The Spirit of Christ is operating in so many people about whom we don't know. To know about them, to know their needs and problems, is to open up our hearts to cooperating with them for the upbuilding of the kingdom of Christ. Our third dimension, lined up for us, in fact, by Pope Paul, is the dialogue with the non-Christian world. This has been called accurately the coming dialogue. Coming because it is still somewhat in its infancy, in the sense that most Catholics are hardly aware of it, although they're necessarily coming to at least hear the names of cities in Cambodia, Vietnam, and the South Pacific, because we happen to be there politically. Actually, as the modern popes, particularly Pius XII, have so accurately pointed out, the modern world is fast shrinking to a point where distance and time are practically erased, almost non-existent. To communicate, for example, ideas, a matter of a split second, from one end of the world to the next. And time, even though we're not still, most of us, riding satellite at a speed of 15 to 17,000 miles an hour, the distance between one part of the country and the other is a matter of hours. From one nation to another, a matter of hours. Lunch in the United States, dinner in France, very common. All of these reasons indicating that God in His providence is uniting the world, but science has outstripped the Spirit. With all the achievements of science to unite the world physically, and more in the offing, yet the union among peoples, and notably here between the East and the West, in the Spirit, where we know them and they know us, we might just as well be living in 1965 B.C. It is therefore this non-Christian world, which is the majority world, over 1.5 billion people, who have never heard the name of Christ, whose visits by Pope Paul should for us be a clarion call to do something with the vigor of Christ, for reasons that we may be sure he was inspired by the Holy Spirit that prompted him to visit the subcontinent of India in order to show his desire of cooperation with a world that will not be Christian for maybe the next 10 centuries. But has been redeemed by Christ and needs our cooperation. In order to bring this down to some kind of intelligible compass, I chose three principal non-Christian religious systems and briefly we'll just display them, hoping to pique at least your curiosity, if not your zeal, and I hope that too, to do what you can. These three are Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam. And as I remind my students, with apologies for reminding you, Buddhism is spelled with two D's. Hinduism, from which, of course, the substantive India is derived, is really not so much a religion as a religious culture, and simply describes the centuries-old religious posture of close to 500 million people in the Indian subcontinent. We may summarily describe in a single sentence Hinduism as the religion which seeks union with the absolute. Seeks union with the absolutes. Hindu literature fills a library. Most of it simply unknown to the Western mind. No wonder those millions have never heard of Christ. We simply are not interested in them. How could they possibly be interested in our Christ? Now, among their literatures, the most popular single writing is the so-called Bhagavad Gita. It's two words, and it's spelled B-H-A-V-A-D, and the second word, Gita, sometimes simply hyphenated or abbreviated to Gita. In this Hindu classic, a god, Krishna by name, declares that whoever worships him with complete devotion, for which the Hindus have a word, bhakti, B-H-A-K-T-I, I quote, such a person dwells in me, whatever be his course of life. They who worship me devoutly are in me, and I also am in them. Familiar words? No doubt Hinduism stresses the unreality of the material universe. It calls it, as I'm sure you've heard, Maya. For the believing Hindu, the visible cosmos, that is the things that we see, the constellations, the sun, moon, and stars, the vegetation, all of this is unreal, pure appearance, or illusion, which is called Maya. No doubt also, Hinduism tends to define, in fact to identify, the ultimate ground of being, as it is called, Brahman, with the self, Atman. So that while claiming that all visible, that is visibly perceptible reality, is illusion, it asserts then positively that the only reality is spirit. And indeed only one spirit. And that spirit is not really close to, but is identified with, the self. And the greatest discovery that a Hindu can make, where he has reached the end of his existence, is to discover that he, Atman, is Brahman. Of course, this is extreme. We call it pantheism. But the urge, the tendency, the hunger to be united in spirit with the one spirit which is the ground of all existence has been the theme of Hinduism since 2600 BC. Now this preoccupation with the spirit, in fact Hinduism is so spiritual it denies the reality of the material universe. It is so utterly spiritual. If it is an essential feature of this type of Oriental religion, have a profound spirituality, then desire of communion between the soul and God should have two effects on us. a standing rebuke to our materialism, and to open our eyes to the potential for building on this love for things spiritual, which we Christians have no concept of. They go to extremes. We with the Incarnation have the beautiful balance of God, pure spirit, taking on flesh. If then we ever hope to affect or influence the almost 500 million Hindus, it can only be through a reappraisal of our own spiritual potentiality. So they will find in us kindred spirits. That's what they're looking for. And we in them, recognizing people, beloved of God, who have in a way discovered God better than many Westerners, in spite of their professed Christianity. You read some of the ancient writings of the Hindus, ancient because they were written in ancient times, the Upanishads. You think you're reading the Gospel of St. John. And only in very recent years has it dawned on missiologists in the Catholic Church. Instead of consigning all these pagans to hell, to examine their culture, their background and tradition, and see what is good in it, what is true, what can we use, what can we build on. Next, Buddhism. Buddhism, historically, is a deviation from Hinduism. Buddha was a Hindu. And, of course, it is called by the Hindus a heresy. Roughly, it is the Protestantism of Christianity. In other words, they had their Reformation in the 6th century B.C. That's when Buddha flourished. It is, however, albeit a deviation, as the Hindus call it, from Hinduism, and almost non-existent in India, where it started, it is the majority religion of Asia, with a claimed 1 billion adherents in varying forms. It can be called, again to summarize it in a sentence, the religion which seeks deliverance from suffering. Buddha, so the story goes, alone in quiet meditation one night, while sitting under a Bo tree, it's B-O by the way, he analyzed a simple religious solution of the cause and cure of evil. His analysis has become the stock in trade of almost 1,000 million people. To understand what he was after, we've got to realize that in Hinduism, one of its cardinal principles is the so-called reincarnation. It means, as I'm sure you know, the belief that when a person dies, he just sheds his body like a person sheds a cloak. The soul continues, takes on another vesture, and so on down the line. What do we become, or who do we become? It all depends on how we've behaved ourselves in our present existence. If we've behaved well, then we become superior or better beings. If we have misbehaved, then a person becomes a lower or lesser being. In fact, it's possible for a person, from having been a human being, to become less than human, merely an animal. And the four castes which classify Hinduism, from the highest Brahman to the lowest, are simply people who have lived on a certain level, for example on a higher level, have misbehaved in that condition, and as a consequence became something less, even to becoming outcasts or pariahs. or, as a matter of fact, becoming something less than human. Buddha was concerned about that, and every Hindu, as a matter of fact, over the centuries, has wanted to escape this so-called wheel of existence. The symbol of Hinduism is a circle. Now, the symbol of Christianity is a cross. The circle, called the wheel of existence, attests the eternal incarnation and reincarnation going on for endless ages. You become in your next existence depending on what you were in your previous one. Buddha claimed you could break that circle. According to him, if you follow his four noble truths, you can escape and be delivered. These truths are profound. They are worth meditations on the part of even Christian religious. The first principle or truth says, all existence involves suffering. To exist for Buddha is to suffer. And it is not coincidental, sisters, that these multi-million people who over the centuries have known almost nothing else but suffering to have identified their existence in this world with suffering. And we, so-called ascetical Christians, who sometimes complain of a slight headache or a misunderstanding, the direst poverty, the most extreme need, existence involves suffering. Second, all suffering, according to Buddha, is caused by indulging our insatiable desires. What's the cause of suffering? Desire. And, sisters, he's so right. We desire things, and our desires are not fulfilled. That's why we suffer. What is suffering, according to Buddha? Unfulfilled desire. Not just according to Buddha, according to anyone who suffers. The third truth, if you want to remove suffering, and this is the theme of Buddhism, you must then somehow suppress desire. To the extent then to which a person has learned to control or suppress desire, he ceases to suffer. Then the fourth and crucial. The way to suppress these desires is his own eightfold path. I won't belabor you with analyzing all of these. This is a course. We spent a semester on this. But we'll pause at a point where we can learn a lot. The Eightfold Path to remove or suppress desire is to have right views. What kind of those? The kind of the Buddha, of course, taught. Right aims, that is, right ambitions, right speech, right action, right livelihood, made in other words, not through dishonesty or deceit, right efforts, and number seven, right-mindedness. This is not a cliche. How many Christians recognize, as Buddha so profoundly discovered, that if I want to have right views, aims, speech, action, and the rest, I must have the right kind of a mind. I must think the right thoughts. For Buddha, I cannot achieve the nirvana which he sought as the deliverance of suffering for his followers. I can never hope to achieve that unless I begin down deep inside and watch my thoughts. By making sure the wrong kind of thoughts are not in my mind, and the right kind of thoughts I put into my mind. This, in its essence, is the universal asceticism of the human race. Anyone who thinks he can practice any virtue unless he has learned painfully to control his thoughts is naive. It cannot be done. And we don't even get the satisfaction of getting praise for our efforts because nobody sees what we're doing. Control of thought is quintessential. So Buddha said for Buddhism, so I can safely say for any search for the divine. Finally, in the last stage, this is Buddhism, in the state of right contemplation, a person enters into that state of nirvana, which, and this is both typical and so encouraging for us Christians, if only more missionaries over the centuries knew this. For them, nirvana means the cessation of desire, which means the cessation of suffering. It never entered their Buddhist minds that a person could conceivably be happy. Sisters, do you know what I am saying? That upwards of 1 billion people believe the highest achievement of man's spirit is simply not to suffer. Do you realize the import of that? Without looking forward to or hoping or ambitioning positive happiness, just not to suffer. That's nirvana. Incidentally, there is a lot of shrewdness. Buddha was a genius. He was more than once asked to more clearly define what he meant by this nirvana. Master, they said, what is this cessation of suffering? What is this nirvana? Well, he always parried their questions, and he said, don't bother me with metaphysics. My hope is that people will be led to achieve nirvana, not to know what it is. And he used an example that I think is beautiful. One of his parables. He said, suppose a man out hunting is accidentally shot by a poisonous arrow. They had no shotguns in those days. He's lying on the ground. His friends run to him. And the arrow is sticking in his chest. He is still conscious. And so they proceed to try to help him to pull the arrow out at least. Then he says, no, don't. Well, you're dying. Well, before you do anything, before you give me any treatment, before you even pull the arrow out, I must know who shot that arrow. I want to know what kind of a shaft that arrow had. I want to know what kind of a poison, what sort of venom was on its tip. Until I know all about the arrow and the one who shot it, I want no treatment. So Buddha says the man proceeds to die. That's marvelous, sisters. How analytic we can become. What metaphysicians of the spiritual life. What wonderful analysts. What books we have on our shelves. Dissecting and atomizing all the virtues, the forms of prayer, the stages of union with God. So preoccupied with the analysis of reality as not to have come into contact with that reality itself. We have a lot to learn from people whom we call pagans. In its principle of nirvana then, or deliverance, that's what the word means, Buddhism teaches us a profound lesson, us Christians, because the dialogue does not come from our complacently treating another person as a nincompoop. as having nothing to contribute to me. It teaches us, if only we have eyes or ears to learn, man's innate desire, which cannot be satisfied. It is insatiable. And for us in the Western world, which is teaching its people that its desires can be satisfied, is it any wonder the Buddhists smile at us, at our shallowness? If it exaggerates, as it does, the presence of suffering, at least it reminds us of something what too many Americans, not excluding religious, almost make a lifetime effort to avoid pain. Living in an anacin, aspirin, antiseptic civilization. Of course, it goes way beyond the evidence, so we believe, in claiming that desires are never fulfilled. But for that very reason, because it is so conscious of suffering, the suffering Son of God appeals to this mind as nothing often would appeal to the blasé Westerner. It also means that our eschatology, our belief in a future life of retribution, what a meaning the parable of Dives and Lazarus would have to a Buddhist. You see, for the pagan, as for the ancient Greeks, those of you that are teaching, say, Greek drama or Roman literature, pretty much the same idea. We're all conscious of suffering. That's human existence. But there's no meaning to it. There's no before or after in paganism. Christianity supplies an answer in both directions. It explains the source of all suffering as man-made. God of himself is infinitely good. He made man, hopefully, to be everlastingly happy. Every pang of pain we experience, every death that men suffer, is the result of their own sinfulness, theirs and that of their forebears. So that suffering, Christianity tells the believer, has been created by man. God didn't make it. God loves. But then, it also can tell those who believe in suffering that suffering has a future, has a purpose to it. It is purifying, indeed ennobling, because God himself became man for one single solitary individual purpose, in order to suffer. That is Christianity in one sentence. God became man to suffer, and by suffering, to teach us how we might suffer and win our salvation, which he gained for us. The vistas that open up, and what a pity that communism instead of Catholicism should have taken over China. Communist China is on our consciences. The final religious system, which is not Christian, that we want to very briefly look at this point, sisters, you see, I'd like to expand myself and just go on and on. I commend to you a number of books, including Religions of the World, which is just coming out in German this fall. The third non-Christian religion, Islam, sometimes misnamed Mohammedanism, means, that is the word itself, Islam means surrender in Arabic. And of course, by implication, it means surrender to God in perfect submission to his will. As with the other two, here too we may summarize in a sentence, Islam as the religion of absolute monotheism. Muhammad, who lived in the 7th century, reacted against the polytheism of his day. He saw immorality rife all around him, all kinds of gods and goddesses, and he was depressed. He believed he had a revelation from God by way of an angel. He wrote the Quran and developed a system which we now call Islam, whose current enrollment is over 400 million. There are two particular features that he built into his religion, both highly significant to us Christians. First, that Allah alone, Allah meaning Al-Ilah, the God, is a pure spirit. He alone is creator and lord of the universe. There are no other gods. To a point where in the Quran, misunderstanding the Christian Trinity, he called Christians polytheists because he thought they worshipped at least three gods. So absolute monotheism, not even a plurality of persons. And second, that man's peace on earth and happiness in life after death depend on obedience to this one deity. Through ritual prayer up to 7 times a day, sisters, if ever you become beleaguered by your spiritual exercises and drag yourself to chapel when you're dead tired, think of the millions of Muslims throughout the world, most of whom are very faithful to their ritual prayer. Anywhere the time of day comes, they're on their knees, gesticulating towards Mecca, worshipping Allah. And as you know, they are supposed to cover the filthy earth, which is considered filthy, with some kind of a cloth or rug, which they carry with them. Or, in the desert, the clean sand alone is worthy of worshipping Allah on. Fasting, really hard fasting. Our Friday abstinence is childish asceticism compared to some of theirs. A full month, for example, of eating nothing all day from sunset to sundown. Already you can eat when the sundown comes. But by that time, if in the hot Arabian desert you have not eaten or drunk a drop of water, I've been told sometimes you almost think you're suffering an agony. Millions keep it. Then through strict compliance with the Quranic code built into the Quran and developed, for example, in a whole nation like Pakistan. Again, lessons for us. You see the sympathy I have with these people. Always coming back to our Western society, notably our affluent United States. Its prosperity has blinded, how true this is, has blinded so many of our fellow Americans to the very existence of a God, where it is calculated 70 million Americans in any given Sunday or weekend do not worship 70 million. And in their daily lives, even those who go to church often belie the profession of faith in that God by their conduct. When American teachers must defend their right in public schools even to mention the name of God, or as in Pakistan in the Constitution, the word Allah appears in the first sentence of that Constitution. And the Quran not may but must be taught in every school. What a contrast. That's Islam. This is supposed to be Christianity. Finally, the dialogue with the non-believing world. This, incidentally, has been recommended, explicitly pointed out and urged upon by our present Holy Father. At first sight, it would seem to be impossible to engage in any meaningful dialogue with those who are not only not Christians, but not even believers in a personal God. Self-styled atheists, but more often agnostics or secularists, whose only admission of reality is to what they can feel, touch, in what they call the empirical world. That's real what I sit and stand on. Everything else is make-believe, a simple homemade definition of empiricism. But according to the late popes, Pope John and the present one, Pope Paul, Catholics should not turn away, may not turn away, from conversation, dialogue, interchange of ideas. And sisters, this means us with these unbelievers. Why not? First, they're sheer numbers. They are, as we know, the leaders of world communism, which has currently enslaved upwards of 900 million people. And in a country like the United States, materialism, atheism, is more rife than most sisters and priests realize. Now, in dealing with this so-called unbelieving world, there are two things that I think specially need to be kept in mind, both incidentally drawn from papal documents. The first is that unbelief, whether in the form of atheism or agnosticism, and it is widespread in the United States, is not a static thing. It's something which keeps evolving and changing. And consequently, these people are subject to dramatic changes of mind and heart. But they must have someone around whom God will use to effect that change. I've seen among my own students, in a matter of weeks, at most months, these people didn't become Catholic. They may not have become Christian. Well, God has His grace, and He knows how to dispense it. A man, for example, my first time that I taught at the university, taught Eastern religions. One of the first quizzes that I gave in class, one of the fellows after the quiz wrote down, "Even to talk about religion or think about God makes me sick." Just disgusted him. We got to talking, and I found out the man's background was as you would expect. No religious training, no faith. No wonder the marvel is that he enrolled in the class, and when he saw the Roman color, stayed one day. But he did. By the time the semester finished, that man, for the first time he said in his life, prayed, realizing there was someone above him on whom he depended. A single change like that would have been enough to warrant my teaching at the university. Let's just for a moment pause here. It means that we who have the truth by presupposition do, in the nature of things, become stabilized. Of course, sometimes we can squat in our stability. Talk about stable. We're immobile. But those who don't have what we have, because they are questing and searching, are constantly on the move. It's kaleidoscopic, mercurial. It baffles you. You think they're out of their mind. No, they're not. They're searching for reality. And all they've got to do is come into contact with us, and the least bit of sympathy for what we stand, and sisters, I'm not exaggerating, miracles take place. Secondly, these unbelievers, and we've got all kinds of nasty names for them, are often sharp critics because they are sharp observers of things that need to be severely condemned. They will condemn racial injustice, hypocrisy in the clergy, in religious, in so-called Christians. They see it. and they blessed it. They criticize wars of aggression. They criticize our not living up to what we're supposed to live up to. Now for us, sisters, to win the sympathetic ear which they must have to make any kind of an impact, a dialogue possible, which assumes at least one pair of lips speaking and another pair of ears listening, that's the least you can have for a dialogue. For them to listen to us, we dare not defend the indefensible, no matter who is guilty. I had this brought home to me, and with this I close. Last fall, when I was to engage in a program, a dialogue, with a man from Temple University by the name of Paul Van Buren, he wrote a couple of books that featured in Time about a year ago. Van Buren is a self-styled atheist. He spoke in the afternoon of Ann Arbor, and I was to speak in the evening. After he talked, I was to give a little critique, and when I spoke, he was to give a critique of his against so-called me. When he finished in the afternoon, I said, Dr. Van Buren, it isn't quite clear where I should classify you. Just not sure just what are you. Then I gave some suggestions. And he said, without batting an eye, I am an atheist. It was a little warm that afternoon. Then he took a drink of water just to gulp it down. Well, that evening, when I finished my talk, he got up for his first rebuttal speech. What I did, anticipating what I just gave you here, realizing this man, in many ways, was a sincere person, a critic of things that needed condemnation. So I spent my time criticizing things that he had spared and telling him that I recognized in him a kindred spirit, but pointing out, of course, how Christianity has answers which he knows not of. When he got up to speak, his first sentence I'll never forget. If what you are saying is representative of Catholicism, I will tell this audience I would be willing to examine your faith. Sisters, these people, universities and walking the streets, who don't even believe in God, and there are many more than most of us think. If on the one hand we recognize that they are changeable and affectable, but above all, that we recognize that behind often their blatant, sometimes violent, denunciation of things, including God, is not of the God in whom we believe. They don't know him, sisters. They don't know him. It is too often the fetish which is worshipped by those who are supposed to believe in the true God. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace.